Jesus. Yeah, but it's Jesus on a t-shirt. That doesn't seem right. I shrugged. My parents and I were locked in the churning cycles of offend and defend, provoke and react, ignore and annoy. The sacrilege of the Dürer t-shirt would irk them, but I also knew that they couldn't complain about the actual image, because it was Jesus. I held up the second black t-shirt, screened and bleached in the same style. Who's that? Malcolm X. Who's he? Who's Malcolm X? Jesus Christ, man. I pretended that Lou was supposed to know better when I myself had only learned about him the previous year. I gave Lou the quick, basic rundown of Malcolm X and the civil rights movement that I had read about in my history textbook. It was a 16-year-old's rehashing of what he remembered from the AP US History curriculum, and Mrs. Romberger would have been proud. Lou looked more confused by the Malcolm X shirt than by the Jesus shirt. Why'd you buy that? Lou's question was childlike and hard to answer, his innocent queries foiling my sharpened ideology. Because it's cool. I mean, it's Malcolm X. He was a total revolutionary. I don't get why you'd get a shirt of him. And besides, they're just t-shirts. Lou shrugged and left my bedroom, overly perplexed by my clothing choices and bored by our conversation about t-shirts of dead martyrs. I was stung by the barb of his naive insight. He was right. They were only t-shirts, but for me, they made a statement, drew a socio-political line in the sand, and maybe they would provoke a reaction. If I saw a Bad Brains t-shirt, I acknowledged an ally. If I saw a Confederate flag t-shirt, I perceived an adversary. And if I saw a United Colors of Benetton shirt, I knew that person was a lemming. In the stores, on the streets, in the hallways, our t-shirts were our nation's flags, chosen with care for the alliances they forged and the conventions they flouted. Jesus on a t-shirt? Malcolm X on a t-shirt? Maybe my t-shirts would offend someone. I was counting on it. The rednecks had been offended by my being Vietnamese and by my hair and clothes. Now, they could be offended by my t-shirt politics, too. The shirts embodied my simplified take on politics and religion and everything else. T-shirt rhetoric for an image-obsessed age. You didn't have to articulate who you were if you could explain it by whom you wore. I wore my Malcolm X t-shirt to school that September, and sure enough, it elicited comments. My peers were more curious than outraged. Who's that? Oh, I see. Malcolm X, huh? I was waiting for a debate, ready to pounce, but no one took the bait. Then, in my AP European history class, Ms. Ganster saw the shirt, and her mouth twisted into a slight pucker. I took surprising pleasure in her apparent disapproval, a pleasure that came from my general provocation rather than from a specific insult toward her. I liked Ms. Ganster. Ah, Malcolm X. I nodded. What did you think of his autobiography? His what? You know, the autobiography of Malcolm X by Alex Haley. She seemed disapproving. I didn't know he wrote an autobiography. I, lowly pawn, had been outmaneuvered by the history queen. Check. Oh, it's quite compelling, quite compelling. You should read it, or at least you should read it since you're flaunting the t-shirt. The insult was subtle, but she knew that pointing out my ignorance smarted me. Checkmate. It turned out that she wasn't offended that I was wearing a Malcolm X t-shirt. She was offended that I hadn't read the book, and I pushed down my embarrassment. The so-called literature guy who hadn't read the book written by the guy on his t-shirt. Textbook poser. That weekend at the Whistle Stop bookshop, I bought a used paperback copy of the autobiography. Faded cover, stark in its red, black, and white design, and a vivid photo of Malcolm X, finger jabbing the air, biting his lower lip. I was not going to let Ms. Ganster have the last word. A few weeks later, I wore my Malcolm X shirt again and lingered after history class. Hey, Ms. Ganster, I read the autobiography. Thanks for recommending it. Oh, you did? Really? She seemed surprised but impressed that I had done it. Trained by Mrs. Ferguson, I rarely let a recommended book go unread, and even if I hated it, I at least tried to read it. Sorry, James Joyce. Yeah, I just finished it. What did you think? I'm still thinking about it. I think he goes a little too far in calling the white man the devil so much. That's kind of intense. I think we all need to live together, right? I guess I'm more aligned with Martin Luther King Jr. than Malcolm X. But Malcolm X seemed to be evolving right up to his assassination, so I'm not sure. That's great that you read it. His assassination was a tragedy in a harrowing series of tragedies in the 60s. And you're right that his autobiography depicts his evolution, his life. He was still growing and learning right up until he died. That in itself is an incredible lesson. Ms. Ganster was sincere, and I was surprised, having assumed ignorantly that my middle-aged white history teacher wouldn't be able to appreciate the radical stand of Malcolm X. But in fact, she viewed Malcolm X's death as a tragedy. She straightened the chables back into their forward-facing rows for the next period. Did the book resonate with you at all, Fuke? What do you mean? Did his life or his writing connect with you and your experience? I didn't have a chance to answer as the bell rang for the start of the next period. I was late for calculus. I'll write you a hall pass for being late. She scribbled out a note for my tardiness. Go on and get to class. We can talk more later. I sprinted down the hall, clutching my pass, flashing it to the hall monitors like an East German checkpoint, and bursting into calculus with my half-open backpack. I threw myself into the nearest open chable. Mr. Cook was unfurling the intricate turns of functions and limits as I pulled out my textbook, but my brain was still in the AP European time zone, mulling over what Ms. Ganster had asked me. I didn't know how to answer her question, because I didn't know what her question meant. Did Malcolm X resonate with me? In that fall of 1990, if pressed hard, I would have said no. I couldn't comprehend it because of how I had compartmentalized my own experiences of bigotry. My parents had never talked to us about racism as a larger force at work, and we assigned prejudice, insults, and bullying specifically to anti-Vietnamese sentiment. In the long shadow of the war, I linked my personal travails to the war's aftershocks and couldn't see how our struggles were connected to a larger struggle for equality. We were not the descendants of slaves. Our people had not marched, sat in, or been fire-hosed. It did not feel like our fight. In high school, I understood racism as a thing that white racist people did and that black Americans suffered. And our history books had the photos to prove it, in black and white. Racists were Klansmen and people who called black people the N-word, sit-ins, bus boycotts, rallies on the steps of Washington. Where did Vietnamese people figure into all of this? Nowhere, it seemed. If I were honest, Malcolm's message didn't immediately resonate with me, because his worldview about race and racism was flexible and responsive, and mine was static at best and cartoonish at worst. My understanding of racism hadn't evolved because I hadn't allowed it and didn't want it to. I didn't want the small, inscribed circle of racists to expand, because if it did, I was terrified it would include more people than just the Klan and skinheads. It was the exclusive club in which no one wanted to have membership. If I put people who made racist jokes in that group, would all my friends go in that pile? Would I also be in that group? What would that mean to include myself in that group? It was a horrifying prospect to even consider that everyone I grew up with and my closest friends were racists, if I broadened its definition. So I didn't. Malcolm X wrote to his mosque, "I have always been a man who tries to face facts and to accept the reality of life as new experience and new knowledge unfolds it. I have always kept an open mind. It was too much to consider and too hard to evolve my thinking about race as Malcolm had done. Malcolm's reality of life was too harsh to behold in the light of the truth. For my own survival and sanity, I kept the racists under their hoods and in the dark. Was I ready to evolve my thinking about race and racism, or was I going to cling to the narrow boundaries of who was racist? Did it matter whether I was ready or not? My evolution would begin, regardless." November 1990. I had quit the library job that summer, though I still volunteered there once a week as a page. I now worked at the mobile gas station at the encouragement of Liam. One by one, during the spring of 1990, our crew of friends had applied for positions at the gas station, and by the end of the summer, all the cashiers at the mobile were our friends. It was the real-life cast of misfits, tasked with running a gas station, and the upsides to the mobile over the library were substantial. I got better pay, $4.25 an hour, worked with my friends when there were two of us on a shift, and when I had the closing shift at night, I perched on a rickety metal stool and did homework, which meant I didn't have to do it after work. With a demanding class load and a lot of homework, getting paid to do homework until 10 p.m. seemed criminally inconvenient. Our sympathetic manager, Scott, was working toward his associate's degree at Harrisburg Area Community College, and he never complained about my reading on the job. Saturday morning, I sat in the fishbowl of the cash register office, flanked by a small steel rack of candy bars and a rotating display of merchandise, oil funnels, ice scrapers, air fresheners. As I wended through my homework, the full-service customers had sharply dwindled. A few times an hour, a car came through full service, setting off the pneumatic bell, alerting me to its presence and needs. Pavlov would have been proud. The bell jolted me up from the register, and I trotted out, metaphorical tail wagging with yes sirs and no ma'ams. Fill them up, squeegee their windows, check their fluids. The mechanics clomped in and out of the office, making change, purchasing a Coke, avoiding the monotony of automotive maintenance. Dirty Dan, so nicknamed by us, ambled to the counter.
What you reading, boy? I laid. What the hell is the I laid?
Dan bellowed. He always called me boy, and I disliked Dirty Dan from our first encounter. His breath was a repellent cocktail of burps and tobacco. I ignored his question, but he persisted. I refused to raise my eyes from the page. Iliad. It's actually pronounced Iliad, like the Iliad.
Well, what the hell is the Iliad?
At least he said it correctly. That a boy. It's about the Trojan War, Greeks versus Trojans. I don't know, I haven't gotten that far into it.
Trojans? You mean like the rubbers? Ha ha ha! You know I'm just fucking with you, boy. Why the hell are you reading that book?
It's for class, homework. I didn't want to get into it with Dan since I was actually enjoying the Iliad, and his idiocy punctured my reading.
I thought you people were supposed to be good at math.
He laughed and slapped the counter several times with a greasy palm.
Math? I'm doing that too. Here you go.
I lugged my AP calculus textbook out of my backpack. I had been procrastinating because calculus was killing me, but I felt the need to show him some identification. This is my calculus textbook. See? Doing math. Big time math.
Calculus? Huh.
He was suitably impressed.
Okay then. Enjoy your book. I laid.
Hand slaps on the counter again. I finished up my shift and skated home, but I sat in my room, unable to finish my homework, because I was feeling too annoyed. And in the idle aggravation of not doing my work, I let loose and felt the full furnace of anger. I was actually furious. Against a lifetime of small and large affronts, my humanity, my dignity, unhinged itself and swung open. I sat in my bedroom that night, fuming. Dan, a nincompoop by all measures, had looked at the color of my skin and the shape of my eyes and told me that I was somehow swerving out of my lane. Who the fuck was he to decide what lane I was supposed to be in? And what did it matter to him anyway? My indignation rose up more as I felt like a punchline to some inside joke, that I was being laughed at, labeled, and pushed into a corner. I decided that I was going to get even with him. I wasn't going to fight Dirty Dan because he was a grown man and I would have gotten fired and probably beaten up myself. And as I had seen from Lou's incident, punching racists was questionably effective. I was going to do what I could in the only context where I had any power. Our high school newspaper. As the editor of the high school paper, I was given one editorial a month to write anything I wanted, and I decided that this was going to be where I'd serve my cold dish of revenge. I was going to write about the incident with Dan. I was going to humiliate him. I knew firsthand the power of words, and I was going to use that power to put him in his place. That is, if he ever read Carlisle High School's monthly newspaper and happened across the editor's column on the second page. Postponing my homework, I scratched out an eviscerating editorial in pencil on a yellow legal pad. My editorial unleashed a seething frustration. I was tired of the narrow path permitted to me because of how I looked, tired of the instant and lazy stereotypes that people applied to me. Did my friends suffer this bullshit? On Monday at school, I handed it to Mr. Moyer, our school paper's advisor. During our newspaper period, he read over my editorial and called me to his desk. I took the table next to his desk and asked him bluntly, "What'd you think?" "I think it's pretty direct. I don't think we've ever had an editorial like this." My anger over the incident was diminished slightly, but I was proud that I was taking a stand and calling it what it was. It wasn't Klansmen or skinheads, but my interaction with Dan was racism, and I dared to say its name. "Pretty shocking, right, Mr. Moyer?" "Absolutely," Mr. Moyer shook his head. "Did this really happen?" "Really happen? Yeah, it really happened. Happened over the weekend." Mr. Moyer continued shaking his head, and I felt comforted by his empathy as he spoke. "I'm sorry that it happened. I'm glad that you wrote about it. But do you think that publishing this is the right thing? I mean, we're not the New York Times or even the Sentinel, and Carlisle is a small town. Someone might be related to or connected to Dan, and you don't know who you'll offend." My airy sense of comfort darkened at the realization that Mr. Moyer was trying to talk me out of the editorial. I countered, "But that's the point." "To offend Dan? Why?" "So he knows he can't say that sort of thing." "You think that it will stop him from having stereotypes or from saying ignorant things? He'll never read it." "This editorial isn't a soapbox for your grievances. You're so smart, Fuke. Why don't you write about something that everyone can relate to, like the SATs? It's the college application season right now, or this mess in Iraq. We might be going to war there. That involves the whole country. Those seem like things that everyone could relate to." This made me doubly furious and even angrier with Mr. Moyer than with Dirty Dan. I was trying to comprehend what I was hearing. Things that everyone could relate to? I heard nothing but Mr. Moyer trying to protect Dan and to redirect me, telling me that my anger didn't have a place in a public forum. I was so angry that I almost wanted to seize my editorial and tear it up in Mr. Moyer's face, but instead, I checked my frustration and spoke as calmly as I could. "This is really important to me, Mr. Moyer. No one reads the editorials or takes them seriously because they're always about non-issues. But racism..." My words broke off and some of the other newspaper students hushed. I didn't want Mr. Moyer to tell me that racism only affected me, the Vietnamese kid, in a room full of white kids. My assistant editor, Jenna, piped up. "Well, I think an SAT editorial would be good. I mean, I don't think the SATs are fair," and I whipped a stinging reply. "No one asked you, Jenna." "Fuke, she's just giving you some suggestions." Mr. Moyer lifted his chin as a sign to Jenna that we weren't done talking. The whole room was silent, my verbal snap having stopped the small group work. I leaned closer to Mr. Moyer, knowing that I needed to salvage my position so that he wouldn't reject my editorial outright. I took a breath and collected myself. Pride swallowed. "I know this only affects me, but it's also really important to me. Maybe no one can relate to it. Maybe you're right about that, but it's also an editorial. What editorials did you tell Laura she couldn't write?" Laura was the editor the previous year. "It's an editorial, Mr. Moyer. I know the difference between an article and an editorial. And I know this seems like a risk, but it's a risk I want to take, and I'm willing to write it and take full responsibility for it." I did the best I could in the moment to appeal to the logic and boldness of the situation, to downplay my rancor, even as I hated the feeling like I was groveling to be heard, because I was, in fact, groveling to be heard. Mr. Moyer looked at my yellow legal pad, his eyes scanning my editorial. "Well, it's too long, so you'll need to cut 50 words for the column. And you can't call Dan a racist pig. Leave it at racist. Lose the pig." "So I can run it?" He nodded. "Yes. Yes, you can." "Thanks, Mr. Moyer. Thanks so much." I would have shaken his hand, but I was nursing a broken trust. It was painful for me to endure bigoted remarks from the garage mechanic, but it was eviscerating and felt like betrayal for Mr. Moyer to ask me to think about offending others with the editorial. But at least in the end, he allowed it, and in his acquiescence, it seemed like a self-inflicted win for me. We ran the editorial at the end of the month. Simplistic because of its word count, my article was clear in its caricature of Dan. Racism was bad. It was easy to hate caricatured racists as it was easy to hate Nazis. And the congratulatory feedback from my classmates was simple and frequent, but it didn't feel victorious. I had to beg for the editorial to be run, and none of my peers on the newspaper had come to my defense or encouragement when Mr. Moyer was trying to talk me out of it. In my editorial, the takeaway was so palatable. Racists were bad people, bad apples in the barrel. But bad apples were easy to spot. What Malcolm X was suggesting was that it was the whole barrel, America, that was the problem. But my teenage brain rejected that notion immediately. I didn't want to believe that the barrel itself was rotten, because I was in that same barrel. That fall, I applied to 3 colleges with minimal assistance from my guidance counselor, Mr. Lebo, who was also the head football coach. His primary duty was coaching, and in the midst of the fall season, college guidance took the bench in favor of running plays and button-hook pass options. We met once in his office, where he asked me a few times to help him pronounce my name, and then he told me I should definitely apply to Penn State because I had good grades. Afterward, he handed me a 1-page handout with tips for writing a college essay and wished me luck. I did apply to Penn State because I knew I would get in, and also because my parents, whose accents made it sound like Peng Stay, insisted on it because that was where my aunt had gone. Also, the in-state tuition for Penn State was affordable, and the 3 of us talked about additional financial aid and loans and grants. By this point, I seldom spoke with my mother and father beyond asking them for checks for the application fees or the use of a car to get to work. They had started taking classes at community college to earn their travel agent's licenses, and between my work schedule and their school schedule, we crisscrossed in our household, a weave of missed connections. Mrs. Krebs and Mrs. Romberger wrote recommendations for me, and I felt as though I had an excellent chance for getting into college. That feeling, of course, was based on the faintest knowledge and understanding of the application process. I checked out the College Board's Guide to Colleges from the library, but its girth and gray pages stifled even my breathy ambitions and aspirations. I knew I wanted to go to college in a big city because, well, because fuck Carlisle. I had offloaded all my frustrations, all my grievances, real and perceived, upon the town, and it symbolized everything I wanted to leave behind. Carlisle, Pennsylvania. An easy symbol for narrow-minded bigotry and limited prospects for teenagers of all stripes. I couldn't wait to put Carlisle in the rear view. I wanted to be around music, culture, art, artists, punks, anarchists, socialists, girls who were well-read and promiscuous. None of that was in Carlisle. I was shocked that some kids applied to Dickinson. Staying in Carlisle for college? No way. Fuck small towns. I felt like I was destined for the big city, the Big Apple, the big time. I applied to New York University, mainly drawn to the idea of living in the big city and being in a city that seemed filled with more fun, more punks, and more people like me. I didn't know anything about its curriculum or the different departments. My parents seemed okay with NYU because my aunt and uncle still lived on Staten Island, and they envisioned my living there to save money. The only other big city that I had frequented and enjoyed was Philadelphia, so I applied to the University of Pennsylvania, which my parents and I thought briefly was the same as Pennsylvania State University. I heard about other colleges and universities to which my classmates were applying, and I skimmed their lists with no sense of where or what. Williams, Middlebury, Amherst, Skidmore, Swarthmore, Georgetown. They might as well have been rattling off Canadian territories, and I certainly had no sense of what a good college was. but I had started to hear the phrase, "Oh, that's a great school," after some schools' names and not others. I had dumbly assumed that college was college and that what you did mattered more than where you were. I requested the 3 applications for NYU, UPenn, and Penn State, and within the month I received their large, bulky white envelopes and the enclosed, polished prospectuses. My mother had gotten a discarded second-hand IBM Selectric typewriter from her insurance office so I could type out the applications instead of filling them out by hand. I filled out each application on the typewriter, one loud click after the next hard clack, the rhythmic sound of opportunity knocking. I homed in on the personal essay and the opportunity to talk about what I loved, of course. I wrestled with what to write about. "Don't talk about being an immigrant. Don't talk about race." Mr. Moyer's advice about my editorial stalked me as I thought about how I would present myself to the wider world. "Don't talk about punk rock or running away or your fucked up childhood. Universal, relatable, aspirational. Talk about your love of books, your love of art, your love of learning. Be funny. Be yourself. No, be better than yourself." I took the SAT 3 times, and I thought my scores were fine. They weren't perfect, but my essay was propulsive. My essay would carry me. My grades were good, good enough for me to be in the National Honor Society for the last 2 years. But I leaned on my essay, my mission statement about the universality of literature, about my love of learning, proving that I was ready for college, ready to be at an institution where they would see me for my intellect. The UPenn application required 4 personal statements and supplemental essays. Undaunted, I wrote multiple drafts in Bic pen on my yellow legal pad. I scratched out edits and moved sections around, slogged through them, essay after essay after essay. Essay 6A. If you were given the opportunity to spend an evening with any one person, living, deceased, or fictional, whom would you choose and why? I must have been feeling punchy or cocky or stupid. On the UPenn essay 6A, I wrote about wanting to have dinner with God. I had been reading Woody Allen's collected essays, Side Effects, and fancied myself a satirist. I went in for the comedic kill, typing out the essay, so sure that I had slayed it with my irreverence and sacrilegious humor. I was the best read kid in my class. I had audited a college course and gotten an A. I was the editor of our school paper and the literary magazine. And in a frenzy of adolescent hubris and ego, and for the first time, I was absolutely confident in my greatness. Punchy, cocky, stupid. But that was me, unapologetically so. And if UPenn didn't want me, then fuck them. Applications mailed. December 1990. I emerged from the gas station's bathroom, shoving the reluctant yellow bucket in front of me as I rounded the corner into the cashier's office. After some robotic mopping motions, I tipped it over outside as it made a foul, retching sound and heaved its gray water into the curbside drain. I rattled the wheeled bucket and mop back into the utility closet. "Okay, that's it. Bathroom's cleaned." Liam gave me a thumbs up. He and I worked the Friday shift because those shifts, between the full-service pump and register, bustled with customers and full-service patrons. "How much time is left? Do we have time to play quarters?" He rooted in his pocket for change. "Yeah, it's like 9:30. Let's do it. It's not that cold outside." I pawed around in my pants for quarters when a police car pulled up in the full-service lane. Liam and I were immediately nervous, and all the petty villainy we had been committing sprang to mind. Stealing lawn ornaments, mailbox baseball, trashing an abandoned farmhouse. That was what I conjured in the 10 seconds while the patrol car idled outside. The door chimed as the officer entered. Black uniform, shaggy brown hair, matching mustache, middle-aged, moderate belly, shoes well-polished but worn. He carried a large white 3-ring binder under his arm. As the doorbell dinged, he glanced at me intently, the cop look where you can tell they're measuring you up, and I stood in the corner with the oil display. Liam stayed fixed behind the counter, and I watched as the cop approached him. The officer's wide frame blocking the width of the counter, and with his dark uniform, he eclipsed the space so that I saw only Liam's face and his recently shaved head. Liam had an incredible Gee Willikers boy next door shtick that had saved our asses on several occasions, and I knew it was best to let him do the talking. "Good evening, officer. Can I help you?" Nice and polite. Well done, Liam. His calm was inversely proportional to my anxiety. I was still adding several other misdemeanors to my mental list, including putting parking cones on top of the Dickinson gym roof, skating in a few pools illegally, and pushing over some cows one drunken night in Dillsburg. The police officer was definitely not there to give us any community service awards. He drawled in his Carlisle accent, distinctly more Dixie than Yankee. "You boys worked here last week? Last Thursday night?" "I did. It was just me," Liam nodded. The officer continued. "Did you see the robbery?" The robbery was the talk of our mobile station. The 7-Eleven across the street had been held up, and the perpetrator had gotten away. Scott, our manager, had posted a memo, and we all clucked about it, and about how robbing a convenience store was another level of criminality that we couldn't imagine. We were content to tip cows and steal lawn gnomes, but brandishing a knife to steal a store's cash was in another league of lawlessness. Liam shook his head. "No, I didn't. I mean, we heard about it from our manager, but I didn't see anything. It's all the way across the street. I can barely see it as it is from here."
"So you didn't see anything?" The officer wanted to make sure.
"No, sir." Liam's golly shucks was working overtime.
"Did you see the culprit? He was a black male."
"I didn't know that, but I didn't see anything." Any dread that I felt dissipated once I had heard that the officer was inquiring about the robbery and not about any of our hooliganism. I pretended to arrange the oil quartz in the corner, unsure of what else to do, but absolutely sure that I should stay out of the cashier area. Their exchange paused for a moment, and the white three-ring binder thudded on the counter, rattling aside the skull penny tray.
"Would you recognize the black male if you saw him?"
The officer flipped open the binder. Over the officer's shoulder, I could see Liam's face as he looked down at the binder. A slight tremor recoiled across his face, but he forced his brow to smooth itself and feign an adolescent indifference.
"What?"
"Take a look at these pictures. You recognize him in these photos?" Liam didn't look down. "No, I don't recognize him. I didn't see anything, like I said." Liam's insistence had gone from redundant to desperate.
"Are you sure?"
The officer continued to flip the laminated pages.
"Yes, I'm sure."
Liam's face went cold and ashen, and I felt his eyes straining not to look at me. The officer spoke clearly.
"Listen, son."
He kept turning the pages of the binder, the word "son" hanging between them, dirty white laundry on the line.
"Don't you want to get another nigger off the streets?"
My dread returned, exponentially terrifying. Liam's voice almost cracked, but he persevered. "I'm sorry, I can't help you. I didn't see anything." The officer finished flipping through the binder for another 5 pages, then closed the back cover.
"All right, boys. You call the station if you think you remember anything."
He pivoted and walked out, never glancing at me as I stood motionless in the corner, leaning into my sagging throne of oil quartz. We were dumbstruck and waited until the patrol car was well away. Liam stared out the glass window.
"What the living fuck was that?"
We couldn't look at each other and surveyed the station lot in the fear that he might return. My whole being was rattled.
"Dude, what was he showing you in the book?"
"Mugshots, I think. I don't know. It was pictures of the black guys in town."
"Seriously?
Like, pictures from when they were arrested?"
"I don't know, man. They had pictures of some guys we were in school with, too. Franklin Jefferson? His picture was in there."
"What? He hasn't been arrested, has he? Franklin? He's still in high school."
"I don't know, man. I don't know. What the fuck just happened?"
Liam shook his head. We closed up the mobile and locked the doors, the gloom of the office now a cave in which we had witnessed a terrible revelation. I wished we could have locked the whole incident in the office in the dark of the night. Liam gave me a ride home. Our usual loud, music-filled drive was instead somber mileage, more inward than homeward. Liam occasionally muttered, "What the fuck?" and we'd rehash the events of the whole exchange. This was our first run-in with someone in a position of power, displaying such blatant racism. This was beyond anything that I was ready for. I had accumulated a thick calculus from years of experiencing bigotry, but it was mostly at the hands of other kids whom I could punch or verbally lash back at. But this incident didn't involve Klansmen or skinheads or Dirty Dan. This was a police officer. He was sworn to serve and protect. He had a club and a pistol. He had authority. And he had a binder with pictures of black men in our town. My narrow definition of what a racist was had to expand, and in the aftermath, the circle widened to include, apparently, some police officers. The reality of life was forcing me to face a vile truth, whether I was willing or not. A letter from the University of Pennsylvania informed me that I was scheduled for an alumni interview with the vice principal of a nearby high school. After some deliberation, I decided to tone down the punk rock look. This was for all my future marbles, and I didn't want some small-town anti-punk sentiment to scuttle my shot at Penn. So instead of spiking my hair on top, I pushed it over into the semblance of a respectable haircut. I wore a button-down vintage shirt that I tucked in, a black London Fog trench coat, jeans, and boots. I looked funky and stylish, but serious and ready for college. The vice principal, Mr. Dougherty, seemed nice. He was tall, athletic, and had a firm handshake, fading cologne, salt and pepper hair, and wore a gray suit. We met in an archetypal principal's office, flag, ferns, degree from UPenn on the wall. He talked at length about being a UPenn man and about his classmates, their business ventures, and their subsequent successes, all of which emanated ostensibly from the wide-ranging and munificent springs of UPenn. I thought it was odd that he was making the sales pitch to me, a kid who had already signed up to be a Penn man. I was ready to enlist in this fraternity, the lauded penmanship. As he was delivering his UPenn spiel, he opened a manila folder and leafed through what seemed, upside down to me, to be my application, my transcript, my SATs, presumably my essays. I couldn't tell if he had already read them or was now looking at them for the first time. "Tell me about some classes that you're really enjoying, Fook." "Oh, well, I really love my honors English class, but I'm really trying to push myself in all areas. I don't know what I'll be good at, but I love reading, writing, and visual arts. And I think it's important to have a broad foundation. So I took a class last year, well, audited it, a Dickinson College religion class, 200 level. I got an A- in that class. But I love learning and reading and the universal nature of great books." "Tell me more about that." He looked interested, resonating with my connection to literature. "Gosh, well, I think that discussing literature has been a chance for me to strip away all the unimportant things, the superficial things. We're all people. We all struggle and strive for the same things. Love, acceptance, a sense of place and belonging. That's the universal struggle, the human struggle. If you and I can connect with each other through a book, we're really transcending the superficial things, the external things, the things that divide us." He was nodding vigorously. I was on a roll. "That's great. I absolutely agree with you about the universal nature of great literature." I didn't know if I was beaming or not, but I felt as though I had the widest grin on my face. "Well, I have to say, Fook, your grades are pretty good." I caught his tone in the way that he said pretty good and mounted my own clarification. "Thanks. I mean, school is really important to me, and I've been working hard, and that's why Penn is so..." He cut me off, looking over one of the pages in the file. "But Asian students, they're really the cream of the crop, right?" I didn't know how to reply to his assertion about Asian students. I glanced nervously across his desk, not wanting to interrupt him. He paused, holding one page in particular. "I mean, the best kids at any high school, if they have Asian kids, those kids are usually at the top of their classes. Your transcript is very impressive, but I expect it from students like yourself. Your people are very diligent. We have some top-notch Asian students here. But I love what you said about the literature thing. That literature thing is good. I'll be sure to mention it. Was he complimenting me or seeing me through the lens of some Asian stereotype? Was he making racial assumptions about me? But wasn't he saying that Asian students were awesome? I'd never expected anyone to say that being Vietnamese was an asset. And now I was wrangling with that statement in the midst of a college interview. My head spun as I tried to recover and redirect the conversation, but I didn't know if I was successful. The rest of the interview was a blur. I was so derailed by his remark. I drove home and glumly ate dinner. My mood went unnoticed by my family, its foulness indistinguishable from any other cantankerous day for Phuc. I wasn't about to tell them that the interviewer said that my transcript would have to be better because I was Asian. It galled me even more so after I had told him that I was connecting deeply on the universal level of literature. I was trying to tell him that I didn't want to see race, that I wanted to get past it, but he told me that he did see race and that I'd have to do better. My suspicions about who and what was racist, its Caucasian chalk circle, was widening to now include a UPenn alumni interviewer. He emphasized my race when all I wanted to do was ignore it. And in my ignorance, the circle widened to include myself, too. I just didn't know it. It would be decades before I could acknowledge how our conversation was showing two ends of the same pendular swing. See race, don't see race. Sunday, after church. We motored home along Hanover Street, and at the red light near the Hardee's, we observed a couple fighting outside a brick apartment building. Even with the car windows rolled up, we heard their muffled profanities, saw their shivering gestures and middle fingers, their tank tops and undergarments far too thin for the December weather. Husband and wife? Boyfriend and girlfriend? Who knew? We could see that the fight had taken itself to the streets. The man and the woman were black. My father stared at them and defrosted the silence. Jeez, look at those black people. Look at them. Lou caught my eye and nudged me. For 2 years, I had been ignoring most of what my father said as part of my truce with him. It was easier for our family. But this remark, his use of those black people, outraged me. I stopped him from saying any more. What did you just say?
What? I just said, look at those black people.
What's that supposed to mean?
I mean, look at them, fighting on the street, half-dressed, on Sunday.
What does black have to do with anything? You don't know them.
Well, they are black. That's just a fact.
Your tone, Dad. That was racist.
Lou jumped in.
Yeah, you can't say, look at those black people. What does that even mean?
My father was shocked that Lou and I were both so agitated. We were calm but intense. It wasn't a fight. The light had turned green, and he kept his eyes fixed in front of him.
Are they not black?
Of course they're black. That's all that I said.
It's the context. It's what you were implying. There is no point to saying anything about them being black.
Jeez, you're too sensitive.
No, Dad. You're not sensitive enough. That's the problem. Jesus.
I swallowed the fucking Christ before it escaped my mouth.
Fop, don't say Jesus like that.
My mother proved my point about tone and context.
Oh, now you care about my tone? Well, don't say black people like it's an insult. Do you really think that you guys are treated any better by white people? Those people that you just saw? We're on the same side.
Same side of what? America is a great country. Americans helped us escape and gave us so many opportunities.
Same side with black people?
Same side of what?
My father turned his head to look at us while we were idled at another red light.
Lou jumped in.
The same side of racism.
My father grimaced. We are not the same as black people. We work hard. I exploded.
Are you kidding me? Are you telling me that black people don't work hard? That's insane.
I wasn't about to let him or my mother start spouting off their bigoted ideas, which we'd heard all of our lives from nearly all our relatives. This was it. In our Ford Fairmont on a Sunday morning, I took a stand, Malcolm X t-shirt or not.
Dad, You cannot make general statements about an entire group of people. I'm not going to allow it. We don't like it when white people do it to us. How could you do it to others? My mother reinforced my father. But what people say about Vietnamese people is mostly true. We work hard. Lou jumped in. It was a full-on yelling battle royale now. And I was surprised to see Lou tagging into the ring to throw some polemical elbows. Was this an inspired upside of his punching Mason? Mom, you can have your own opinion, you know. You don't always have to side with what Dad says. Lou, who didn't even know what the patriarchy was criticizing the entrenched patriarchy of Vietnamese culture. I backed him up. Yeah, Lou's totally right. Mom, you should have your own opinions. You don't have to have the same ideas as Dad. The conversation had careened from racism to sexism in a sharp angle, and my father defended himself. Of course your mother has her own opinions. Honey, tell them. Tell them you have your own opinions. My mother nodded. It's true, I do. She said it so earnestly, so unaware that my father had commanded her, that both Lou and I started screaming, hitting each other with disbelief over the irony of it all, yelling, "Are you kidding me?" and covering our faces at my mother's insistence of her own independence. We argued all the way home, neither the front nor back seats budging, and by the time we pulled into our driveway, we were a house divided against itself. It was our Vietnamese Civil War in a microcosm. Generational, cultural, and racial. Our respective bedroom doors slammed, and before long, I headed off to the mobile station for my Sunday shift. Relieved at the chance to have a break from my parents, I pumped gas and did my homework, sitting at the counter and tuning in to the public radio station. The doors opened and a voice drawled, "Do you people have any oil? 10W30? I'm sorry, what? Did he just say you people? You people have any 10W30? But then my ear recognized that this was a different context and a different tone. You people, being tossed about in a casual way, meant to address anyone who was sitting behind the counter. Oh, right. Yeah, right over there. Maybe my dad was right. Maybe I was too sensitive. You people wasn't always a secret way of saying something bigoted, but I had heard it from a mechanic. I had heard it from a University of Pennsylvania alumnus. I had heard it from my father. In those instances, there lurked a subtle judgment, yet I couldn't quite articulate it. It was easy to spot racism when it shaved its head, drew a swastika, and wore Doc Martens with white laces. But what about when it came to your coworkers, or during the college application process? The police, your parents, you and your friends who said the N-word without flinching. Who are the racists now? I suspected the answer and didn't want to say it aloud. The answer slithered all around me, on the streets, in the patrol cars, across the interview desks. It was even in the mirrors. This was the real lesson I learned from Malcolm X, the one I had been avoiding. And like Malcolm, I had to evolve my own thinking. But for me, that meant confronting a hideous truth about who the racists were. This was the hardest thing he had written about. It would be a long time before I could begin to understand how big racism was and how it affected me, but I had to take the first step to acknowledge the reality of life, to tackle the hardest truth if I wanted to fight it. We all were the racists. Chapter 11. The Iliad. December 1990. English class. Oh, for fuck's sake. I rolled my eyes back into my head, pupils rounding the full orbit, and I swore I saw the blackness of my own cranial cavity. Grace and Sarah were arguing that the Iliad was pointless and had no relevance to their lives as two 17-year-old girls from Carlisle, PA. Homer versus girls wearing swatches and ponytails? It was what you would have expected teenagers to say about an ancient Greek bard, and I couldn't restrain myself. I raised my hand, and finally Mrs. Ferguson called on me. "You guys, it's about greatness and power. It's about being the best at something and still not having power." I couldn't tell if Grace and Sarah were playing dumb or were actually just dumb. Sarah shrugged. "I don't get it. We all know what it means to be the best at something. You win the contest or whatever. That's how we know you're the best. How does that not give you power? I nodded. Exactly. That's the exact question that Homer is asking. What's it mean to achieve greatness and to be powerless? What if you win the proverbial contest and you're still not the best? Grace jumped in, only tangentially picking up Sarah's point. She was doing that thing where kids just give a plot summary under the guise of analysis. The Trojans steal Helen, sort of, the Greeks are mad about it, and the Greeks are also fighting with each other. This just doesn't mean anything to me, but it's my opinion, Fuke. You're entitled to yours, but you can't bully other people into thinking that something is a classic or a great book. We know you like it, and no one is trying to convince you that you can't like it. We're just saying that it's boring and irrelevant to us. To us! I pretended to die on my desk, thudding my forehead on my table's top, crying out an epic groan worthy of a Homeric simile. My classmates laughed at the dramatics. I liked Sarah and Grace, but I was sure that they were so wrong. That's fine to have your opinion, but I want you to see what you're missing. I'm not trying to convince you that your feelings are wrong. I'm saying that there's more work to be done on your part beyond reading a book and deciding whether you liked it or not. That's lazy Siskel and Ebert thinking. This is not about giving Homer one or two thumbs up. This is about asking, what is Homer trying to figure out? Okay, look, let's take tennis, for example. Grace, you're one of the best tennis players on the team, and everyone says you're the best, and you always beat your opponents. But what if you weren't allowed to be the team captain? And what if, even though you were the best, you got benched by the captain? That wouldn't make sense. Why would the captain bench me? Exactly. That's the conflict between Achilles and Agamemnon. Achilles has physical power, but Agamemnon, a freaking idiot, is the one who has political power. So what do you do when the captain benches you and then the team is losing the game or the season? Do you quit the team? Do you argue with the captain that you should be put back in? Try to convince her that you're worth it? Sarah jumped in. But everyone on the team knows that Grace is the best tennis player. Totally, you get it, Sarah. You just named the other problem. There's shame involved when, within the whole group, you're the best, but not the most powerful. The girls nodded in agreement to my point, but I didn't stop. These are some of the essential questions of the Iliad. Achilles' conundrum is complicated because he is the best fighter on the Greek side, but not the leader of the Greeks. And then he's shamed in front of the whole group. The MVP on the team, but not the captain of the team. And there's this same issue between society and war, the underlying tension between political power and military power. It's a tangled social mess that involves people, politics, and the power of the group. If the group decides that you aren't powerful, if someone else in power decides that you are not the winner, then you are not the winner. Too bad. And then you really have to ask yourself, what does it even mean to achieve greatness if that doesn't determine power or status? What does it mean then to be great or to be the best? Does it even matter? I don't know. I don't know if it even matters, at least in society. In war, you kill or be killed, and it's simple for Achilles. But in the political system, Achilles can't figure it out. The system seems rigged. I mean, maybe it is all rigged. Another one of my tirades in English class, one that left a burbling wake of quasi-nihilism, silent stares, and awkward book thumbing. Mrs. Ferguson nodded. Okay, thanks for that, Fuke. Let's make some room for other voices, people we haven't heard from. I nodded at the irony of it. I had finished saying my piece about greatness and power, and Mrs. Ferguson was subtly, and rightly, asking me to shut the fuck up so other kids could throw in their 2 cents. Kids who probably hadn't done the homework, didn't care about Homer, or had no clue. I didn't want to say that I was Achilles, but I felt as though I were in a class full of Agamemnons. The system was all rigged. What did it matter if I was the best student in our English class? It didn't seem to matter in the college admissions process because the candidate pool was so much bigger than I had anticipated, and the rules were not what I had thought they were. I was a good candidate, but apparently not good enough for an Asian student. My confidence was shaken by the alumni interview and left me feeling like maybe I wasn't really good or great at anything. Whatever blue ribbons or gold keys I had attained over the last few years felt like inconsequential tin badges. Those weren't the laurels of the battlefield. They were scholastic prizes doled out by a faceless committee. And the awards had no effect and bestowed upon me no special privileges, especially in the admissions process. Earning good grades and the respect of my classmates, I was still hounded by a feeling of being the outsider, by a ghostly, piercing voice that told me I didn't belong there. And in my punk crew, in which we wore our outsider status proudly, I had to admit to myself, I didn't actually want to be an outsider anymore. My crew was bound by our ostracism, and my membership in our group was an ironic and short-lived salve to stanch my deeper wound, my gaping need to find my place. And it wasn't just about achieving greatness in a vacuum. I wanted people to acknowledge it too. Star Wars didn't end with Luke blowing up the Death Star. It ended with him getting a medal and having everyone clapping for him. The climax was his achievement of greatness and his public praise. In retrospect, my desire was so simple yet impossible to fulfill alone, as if I were trying to play tag by myself. I needed other people, and that need felt embarrassing. It felt weak to admit it, but it was true. I wanted to feel like a valued member of my school and my town, even as I rejected my town and my school. Punk rock, you're so confusing. I didn't even feel like a member of my own home, the place where I felt least safe and hardly regarded. And atop those tangled feelings and desires was my own self-perception. Even if I were publicly celebrated, if my peers did value me, would I believe them? Would it be a futile effort to extol someone like me, who felt so low, eroded by so many insults and exclusions, large and small? How could I rise up from that? How could any feeling of agency or power bloom from such muck and mire? The worries about greatness, power, and shame weren't just Homer's. They were my worries, too. January 1991. When I worked at the Coral Reef at the mall, I had become friendly with a bookstore clerk, Damon, at Walden Books. He was working on his MFA in creative writing at Penn State, and I'd stop into the store even after I'd left the mall job to chat about books, pick up discounted titles, or a magazine. Damon always made time for a friendly debate, even as his pile of reading or clerical duties mounted high to his left. We'd argue about Faulkner, James, or Proust, and he'd tell me about his MFA program in graduate school, about which I knew nothing. Our talk that January turned to my college applications, and I mentioned the three schools to which I had applied. "Did you look at Bard College?" Bard? I'd never heard of it, but he could have listed off all the Ivy Leagues and top-tier liberal arts colleges, and I wouldn't have recognized half of them either. "I haven't heard of Bard. What's it like?" "Oh, it's a funky school. Artsy, punky. You'd love it. I mean, Hampshire, Reed, St. John's, they're all liberal arts schools. But I think you'd really love Bard." I was sold as soon as I heard punky. A college for punk rock kids? I sent away for the prospectus, and when I got it 2 weeks later, I felt a shiver of shared humanity. The brochure read, "Bard College, a place to think." Fucking yes! A place to think. A place that cherished and nurtured the process of intellectual pursuits. This wouldn't be a college that would check my jockstrap or fail me for gym class or make me get hall passes whenever I was late. But then, I saw that it was in a small town. The description of Annandale-on-Hudson was idyllic and, for me, revolting. Annandale-on-Hudson was not the metropolises of New York or Philadelphia. It appeared to be the splinter of an outpost 100 miles north of New York City. But everything else about Bard sounded like it would be a haven for me, so I convinced myself that this seemed within the orbit of the city and that New York State was still closer to New York City than anywhere else. I filled out the Bard application last minute and convinced my reluctant parents to write a fourth check for the application fee. They wondered who needed to apply to four colleges, but once I explained to them that Bard offered a special scholarship for students who graduated with a top 10 GPA of their high school, matching their state school's tuition for their 4 years, they relented. That seemed like an incredible opportunity. I put the Bard brochure at the bottom of the stack. I still had all my urban university hopes pinned blindly on UPenn or NYU, despite the fact that I had not visited either of those campuses. And if my first two choices denied me, I would maybe go to Bard. If all three options failed, I would go to Penn State and transfer somewhere else later. And regardless, any of those college selections were better than the armed forces, whose recruitment officers were harassing me weekly because Connor, thanks you dick, had jokingly listed me as a likely candidate. The recruiters called often, and my parents panicked that I would be drafted and flown off to Operation Desert Storm to fight for Kuwaiti freedom and cheap oil. Sometimes the recruiters would even come to our house, knocking on our door in full dress uniform. If I had taken a moment to empathize, to pull my head out of my own ass, I would have seen real dread in my parents' eyes, a dread that was stitched with their old world experience, dyed by the blood of drafted brothers and cousins, and sewn into a long, unwinnable war. In retrospect, I realized how my parents draped the hopes of college and greatness upon me, their eldest born. They snuffed out their own ambitions, exchanging their dreams for their children's, hoping that our lives would be full of possibilities and free from devastation. My vague but lustrous potential would be built upon the heavy shards of their broken futures. February 1991, Friday night. Our band, Squareback, named after Nate's Volkswagen Squareback, had finished practice. Rehearsal was winding down in Liam's basement, and we were fooling around, taking turns on the bass, guitars, drums, and the mic. Byron was really good on drums, but the rest of us were equally bad on vocals, guitars, and bass, and you couldn't tell if the right person was playing the wrong instrument. Liam's parents, long-suffering of skateboard sessions and impromptu parties at their house, were happy to support the band, a relatively safe, zero-crime enterprise, and to tolerate the five of us rehearsing in the basement, because it meant that they knew we were not getting into trouble. We had all had various encounters with Carlisle police at this point. Tickets, summonses, license suspensions. So there we were in the basement, Nate, Liam, Byron, Gabe, and I, rehearsing our eight songs for an upcoming show at the Mifflin High School gym. I had traded guitars with Gabe, and we switched our effects pedals. "Hey, do you guys want to try something a little different? I've been listening to My Bloody Valentine, and they have a really cool sound. It's not exactly our sound, but it's got a lot of distortion and noise. Let me show you." I detuned his guitar to an open E chord, turned up the volume and reverb, plugging in the delay and distortion pedals. I struck a sequence of chords that made a woozy, minor key progression, up and down, churning and throbbing. It was slow and simple enough that Byron started playing along on drums, and Liam jumped in on bass, and Gabe started playing a riff on top of the noise. We churned on the chord progression for a while, and Nate started yelling some lyrics. I shouted out to Nate over the music, which didn't sound half bad. "You don't really yell to this. I mean, it's not exactly a punk song. Just sing. Like, sing something instead of yelling it." Nate had never properly sung anything, and we didn't know if he'd be able to carry a nope, totally off-key, terrible. After a few minutes, we all knew it wasn't working with the vocals, and we stopped playing. Nate shrugged. "That's not really my thing, dude. Singing, I mean." Gabe couldn't resist. "Oh, 'cause you thought lead singer meant something else? Or was our flyer for a lead singer misleading because you have the literacy of a third grader?" Laughter and an exchange of middle fingers. Gabe gave me a thumbs up. "That sounded cool, Fook. We should do more songs like that." Byron nodded from behind the drums and assented. Nate shook his head. "That's cool if that's what you're into, but it's not what I signed up for. I ain't singing, at least not like that." Liam nodded. "Yeah, it's not exactly sounding like what we said we were going to play." "No, I get it. That's cool. We have a harder sound. The songs we have are good. The Mifflin show will be cool." I said it nonchalantly, but I was disappointed as we were bumping up against the limits of punk and arguing about what our band was supposed to sound like. Why couldn't punks play something other than punk? Did that mean we weren't punks anymore? But what would be more punk than being authentic to yourself? I decided it wasn't worth bringing up as I unplugged my guitar. As we all spooled our amp cables and helped Byron break down his drum kit, Liam and Nate discussed getting food at a truck stop. Let's go to the All-American. You guys in? Gabe and I shook our heads. Byron needled me and Gabe. The fuck you guys doing? Too cool to hang out with the boys on a Friday night? Oh no, you're very handsome, all of you, but, I paused. I have plans to hang out with Molly. I had started hanging out with a girl in the 11th grade, Molly, whom I had met on a National Honor Society field trip. It was the most fucking nerdy way to meet a girl, but there we were now, dating and making plans for a Friday night. Nate high-fived me. Nice, Fookster. Good choice. I'd totally choose getting my dick sucked over hanging out with us, too. I frowned at his remark. It's not like that. Nate looked horrified. No sucky sucky? Dude, no, we don't do it like that, I said, ignoring Nate's fake Asian accent in his joke. Ooh, kinky. Tell me what it's like then, I'm all ears. We just hang out, talk. Liam jumped in. Talk? What do you talk about? About the lack of blowjobs happening? These guys were my crew, so I decided to just be honest. We talk about movies, music, books, whatever's on our minds. It's nice. Actually, it's really cool. She's cool. I'll bring her around. Nate piped up. Does Molly have any friends who will suck dicks? We all groaned. I shook my head. Jesus, man, at least have the self-respect to use the phrase my dick. The plural dicks is gross. She's not on the fucking turnpike handing out blowjobs like candy. Nate snorted. Excusez-moi, Professor AP Literature. Does my use of the plural offend you? Let me rephrase the question. Does your Molly have any friends who will suck my singular dick? I laughed that even my crew had picked up on my reputation as the literature guy. Professor AP Literature? Nate, come on. We all know you don't even know how to spell AP. And no, Molly does not have any friends who will suck dicks or dick. And not your dick. Byron packed up his kick drum. Well, she sounds very reasonable if she ain't sucking down bags of dicks at the turnpike. You should bring her to a squareback show sometime. I shrugged a maybe, and everyone turned their attention to Gabe. Okay, Gabe. Fookster's got an excuse. What's yours? We know you don't have a date. Not going out with us to the All-American? We can show you a good time, big boy. Nate reached up and cupped his own chest, caressing it like a pair of breasts to emphasize the enticement of big boy, while Gabe shook his head. Nope, sorry. I gotta finish the intake on the Nova. It's the last thing to do, and then she's up and running. You guys are gonna fucking love how fast she is. Gabe lit up as he talked about his car, his prized possession, a maroon 71 Chevy Nova restoration he was doing with his brother and dad. Outside, Nate, Liam, and Byron piled the amps, drums, and themselves into Byron's car. Okay, suit yourselves. We'll give you guys a call tomorrow night? Totally. Gabe's giving me a ride home. I'll see you guys later. Gabe and I gave quick waves as he and I got into his parents' car. On the ride home, we talked about forming a side project to play different music, although Gabe was reluctant about playing just acoustic guitars, which was too much of a departure, even for him. In my driveway, he popped the trunk for me to grab my guitar. So what movie are you and Molly going to watch while she's not giving you a blowjob? I laughed. You guys and your fucking blowjobs. There's more to life than sex, you know. But not much more. Anyway, you're gonna love the title then. Sex, Lies, and Videotape. He shrieked in disbelief. What? How are you not going to get a blowjob from this movie? It's not like that. I just like talking to her. And yeah, we make out and shit, but it's different. Like, we enjoy similar things, but not exactly the same shit. It's fun to talk to Molly. She's got a brain and she's cool. I don't know. Gabe got quiet. It does actually sound awesome. It is awesome, actually. But you have to agree. It'd be better with blowjobs. I'm not answering that. I'll take that as a yes. Gabe laughed and patted my back sympathetically as I headed into the house. Molly was my first official girlfriend in high school, and she wasn't a covert after-school affair like Charlotte was in ninth grade. Molly wasn't into punk or so-called alternative music, but she was funny and smart, and as a junior, she blushed in the attention that I, a senior boy, lavished upon her. My parents liked Molly, a nice Irish Catholic girl who went to St. Patrick's, played the cello, and waved to them at Mass. In turn, Molly's parents were kind, a bit wary of me, but ultimately warm and loving. At first, they didn't know what to make of our dating. Who was surprised that teenage boys were foul-mouthed and single-minded in their pursuits? But between Molly and me, my heart wasn't drawn to easy sex, and it soon became apparent to even her parents that I really cared for her and that our relationship wasn't wham-bam, thank you, ma'am. If anything, it was a bonnet upon it, I wrote you a sonnet. In our kitchen, she made small talk with my parents about school and her parents and last week's homily at Mass, and then my parents retired to their bedroom by 9 p.m. Lou had a sleepover at a friend's house, and in the living room, we put in the VHS cassette that I had rented from West Coast Video. As the piracy warning flickered, she nuzzled into my shoulder. So what's this movie about? Well, the title might tell us since it's Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Clever title, so subtle. It's a porno then? Jesus, you couldn't pay me to watch porn with my parents down the hall. Also, how dare you insinuate that I would make you watch porn? I would definitely tell you first. And the title wouldn't be so obvious. Porn titles have weird puns in them like Flesh Gordon or Little Whores on the Prairie. Classy titles like that. This is an indie film. It's supposed to be art. I stretched out the word art in a British accent and pretended to adjust a monocle and stroke my imaginary beard. Molly rolled her eyes.